This week in Retronauts, my, the Earth really is full of things. Hi, everyone. Welcome to a bonus episode of Retronauts. I'm Jeremy Parrish, and we're doing something different this week. We're changing all the rules, breaking the law. We are having a crossover Retronauts East-West episode, and here on Skype with the Retronauts East folks, we have none other than...
Hello, everybody. It's Huge Ball of Garbage, Bob Becky. How's it going?
That's fantastic. Bob is calling in from the West Coast, while those of us on the East Coast are very cold and huddled together in a room for survival. Mm-hmm. And snuggled up to me here in the studio, we have
Ben Jedwards,
and also
Ben Elgin.
And we are going to talk this week about a game that is near and dear to all of our hearts, Katamari Damacy. That's right. There's going to be a lot of people just scatting and humming throughout this episode. Anytime the topic comes up, these guys just start singing. So
pretty much.
So just kind of brace yourself for that. But don't worry, I'll be splicing in lots of music because you can't talk about Katamari without talking about the soundtrack. But this topic is suddenly relevant again, thanks to the fact that Bandai Namco said, you know what? We have this amazing series called Katamari Damacy, and we should reissue it on Steam and Switch. And the Switch port, I've been playing it a lot, and I love it. It's just such a perfect fit. And they didn't really do anything to change the game from the one that appeared 15 freaking years ago, if you can believe it's been that long. And it's still just an amazing, wonderful, little heartfelt experience. And so... we've talked about doing a Katamari episode for ages, and everyone in this room is like, yes, we need to do it. So here we are. We're doing it.
Yep.
So, I'd love to hear from you guys how you first discovered the Katamari series. And Bob, why don't we start with you?
I think it might have been your coverage on 1UP that got me into it. Were you previewing it or something like that at the time?
Oh boy, we'll talk about that.
Okay,
yes.
That's probably. I mean, I was a hardcore weeb, and I still am. And I was into anything that was super Japanese and that had like a fun and weird concept. And I was definitely attracted to it from the beginning. And it helped that Namco released it at like I think $30 instead of $50, which was the common price for games in 2003. Mm-hmm.
It was like 60, 70 kind of the standard going price fairly early in the PS2.
It was a nice budget release.
In Dirt World, Ohio, it was still $50. But
wow, okay.
I have to say, yeah, I mean, the weirdness of the concept plus, you know, the cool graphics and the price and everything really got me into it, and I was a huge fan of it from the very beginning. I think I pre-ordered it, and I just confused everybody at the store that I pre-ordered it at because they're like, oh, somebody wants this. And my only regret about the new collection you mentioned is the fact that they don't include the second game, which is the better game. And in my opinion, there are only two Katamari games. That's where I stand.
I did kind of have the same opinion that I was like, you know, I'm really glad that this was being re-released, but I kind of wish they had done the second one, you know, either in addition or instead, just because, you know, there's some refinements in there that are nice. But yeah, it's great to have it in any form.
So, Ben, how did you first stumble across Katamari?
I think this may have actually been the same thing. I mean, I was definitely reading you guys back then too.
I was really hoping to have more interesting approach vectors than me, but well, okay,
it's all you, Jeremy.
But this was really in a period in the PlayStation's history where we're like one of the big appeals of the platform is that we were starting to get more and more of these like weird little releases from Japan that were, you know, not in some established genre, that were just trying weird things, and that really appealed to me a lot. And again, you know, this coming out of the budget price made it really easy to just jump in and try it. And it was just fantastic. I do acknowledge a few more releases in the series than Bob does, although they did start to draw it pretty thin. And we'll get into that later. But yeah, it was just a great time from day one.
Yeah, so I was a huge EGM reader from like 92 to the end of its first run, the classic EGM. And I probably...
It's been 10 years ago.
Yeah, that's crazy. Can't believe it. But yeah, I probably heard of it through EGM, and it may have been Jeremy writing about it for all I know, but I don't remember that specifically. whoever.
I was not the only person writing about it. It took a little while for, I would say, other people in the US press to catch on to it, but I'm not taking credit for having like discovered it or anything. I was sort of introduced to it by someone I worked with and just immediately fell in love.
Yeah, well, this is the funny thing about Jeremy's coverage at that time was that I identified with you and your quirky sort of tastes and sensibilities. And obviously, we've discovered we have a lot in common in terms of things like Symphony of the Night and things like, I remember you talking about Odin Sphere, really cool. It made me want to buy Odin Sphere. And so, yeah, it was probably Jeremy. I have no idea. But the first time I ever played it was from, is that part of the question? Because, sure.
Like, just how you discovered it, we can also talk about what made us fall in love with the game.
Yeah, well, the cool thing about it is that I didn't have a PS2 until probably 2004, even though it came out in 2000, something like that. And my brother gave it to me for my birthday because I couldn't afford it at the time. And the first game I got for it was Katamari Damacy because I wanted to play it so bad. So nice. That was, and I sat there, I just sat down and played it all the way through until like the first sitting till the end.
And that's really interesting because I don't think anyone would have looked at Katamari Damacy in 2004 and said, oh yes, this is a system seller, but it literally was a system seller for you.
Yeah, it was. Cause I'm weird, man. I mean, that's.
But yeah, like Ben said, that gets to kind of what made the PS2 so powerful is that, publishers were really able to take a risk at that point. Game development hadn't ballooned in cost like it did with HD graphics a few years later. And the production of DVD-ROMs and CD-ROMs was so cheap that they could afford to, take risks on little odd things like this. And the reach of the PS2 itself was so extensive, and it just like everyone owned one, whether they wanted a game system or a DVD player. There was like no downside to putting stuff on PS2. Like enough people would buy something like this that you could make back your cost of localization or whatever. So yeah, I feel like it was really kind of in the vanguard of this sort of really really fertile era of creativity and localization on PS2. And Japanese publishers and American publishers really kind of around this time had been making a real effort to bring over more games. And Katamari was kind of, I think, emblematic of that. And, I honestly didn't expect the game to come over. And I was sort of newly introduced into the gaming press at that point. I had just started working at 1UP.com like a year before that. And I feel like I was kind of an ass and had a lot of like a chip on my shoulder and was like looking back, I'm like, I needed to kind of tone it down a little bit. But I just felt like, I really love classic games and smaller, quirkier games. And that kind of thing didn't get a lot of coverage in the mainstream American press at the time. And there wasn't really much of a network of smaller sites and smaller publications
that didn't
to support
really
it.
Exist, yeah.
Social media didn't exist. So yeah. It was hard to get word of mouth out. So I feel like maybe I pushed a little too hard and was a little bit strident about saying like, hey, people need to pay attention to this stuff. But I also kind of felt like if I don't do it, what other coverage is this stuff going to get? So Katamari was one of those games that I was introduced to by a coworker, Kevin Gifford, who ran TSR's NES homepage back in the day and does localization work now. And he kind of mentioned that on his personal blog. And I was just like, this game looks incredible. It's like everything that I love about video games. It's simple and it has a unique graphical style and the music is amazing and it just has a fun personality. I love this and I really went to bat for it and actually got in trouble at work for it. Our publisher kind of like called me in on the carpet and said, you need to like not write about stuff like this so much on your 1UP blog, but maybe write about things that people actually care about.
Ooh.
Jokes
on them.
Then at E3, like
Where
a month later.
Now? Sorry.
Right. At E3 2004, Namco actually showed this game off. And I was like, it was kind of as a test. They were like trying to gauge interest and say, like, should we bring this game over? Which that never happened. Like, who took a game to E3 just to see if people like to dangle it in front of people? I had never heard of that happening, but people like flocked to it. They loved it. They were kind of like, what is this intriguing thing? And they tried it and they played it, and pretty much everyone fell in love with it.
I think I was going to say, I think it still helped that we were in sort of the tail end of the quote unquote wacky Japan era of marketing, in mm-hmm. which that could be a hook for people. Like, look at this wacky Japanese thing. And that could be a draw, which is why they never changed the name when they brought it out over here. Like, that was genuinely surprising that they didn't call it something else. It's my
I agree. Like, I was surprised that they brought it over, but I was very happy. And I was surprised that they didn't try to, like, they didn't fundamentally change it. They didn't try to make it extreme. They didn't give the prince angry eyebrows. Yeah. They didn't call it, like, big balls or something.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many ways they could have just screwed this up.
It is a,
like,
game
how
about
how big are your balls? Get the biggest balls in the galaxy. Like, they could have, like, gone lowest common denominator, but they didn't. They were just like, here's this unusual game from Japan.
They leaned into how Japanese it was because fundamentally they couldn't make the game not take place in Japan and be very Japanese. It would take too much money and work. So they just really had to lean into how Japanese the game is, I think.
Mm-hmm. That's a fascinating point, Bob. Actually, I never thought about that because they couldn't afford to redo the whole game.
Yeah, like,
because it's all Japanese objects and houses and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, like, yeah. Probably 25% of the objects in there are pretty specific mm-hmm. to. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, most stages you either start out in a Japanese home or a mm-hmm. Japanese town, and there's no question about it. Like, those are not hamburgers. Those are onigiri.
Yeah.
You start no one's gonna buy it if you say otherwise.
Yeah.
Well, this was the first game I ever played that was that I had bought that was really fully unabashedly Japanese, and, you know, it wasn't localized, like you're saying. It wasn't changed much as far as I know, and it was in the, I mean, the whole freaking soundtrack is in Japanese, of course, too, which is another thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of English in it too.
But you know what I mean, it's done by Japanese artists, and there's plenty of Japanese. They didn't make a whole new soundtrack for American, like with like Blink 182 or something.
It's no Sonic CD, that's for sure.
Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, it was here, this is Japanese, and we're not embarrassed about it, and it's awesome. And so I loved that about that game. It's just an expression of joy all the way through to me.
Yeah, the packaging and the marketing kind of, I think, not rode the coattails, but they sort of caught the spirit of something that had kind of become a little bit of a motif or a theme in the classic gaming blogosphere that existed at the time, the idea of blue sky gaming, which is very uh-huh. associated with Sega. But the, I totally forgot what they're called. I can't remember the name of the website, but there was a blog that was like super into Sega. And they always talked about like blue sky gaming and about how, you know, games like Outrun had this sort of bright, optimistic feel that you just don't get in video games anymore. And if you look at the package to Katamari Damacy, It absolutely does. Like, it is, yeah, you know, like a blue sky and a rainbow and, yeah, and very like kind of abstract, colorful graphics.
That cover is awesome too.
It's so
like
good. Yeah.
Right, up,
yeah.
Cows,
like,
and
they
stuff.
Just, oh, they just embrace the nature of the game. And, you know, we've been saying like, oh, this is a very Japanese game, and it is, but I think, you know, even among games from Japan, it's unusual. And that's because it was designed by someone who is not really by trade a video game creator. The creator of Katamari Damacy, who directed the first two games, is an artist named Keita Takahashi, who actually, I think, lives in the Bay Area now.
He does, yeah.
Yeah. And he has like a very international outlook and a very like almost kind of like a hippie outlook. He's very much into the idea of community and peace. And he hates the idea of seeing like his work turned violent and that sort of thing.
Yeah, he does things like designing playgrounds, you know, playground equipment and like community installations and that kind of stuff. Yeah,
yeah, and the games he's created since Katamari are only kind of games. They're more like toys or amusements or interesting abstractions and experiments. You know, like Nobi Nobi Boy. That was the one that mm-hmm. like he was trying to get to the edge of the solar system, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, the girl was stretched boy. It added to girl, and
So it took the collective efforts of everyone who played the game and pooled them together into like this system wide achievement that they were trying to reach, and eventually they did.
But and the gameplay itself was barely, like, there was barely game there. It really was more of a playground. Like, here's some equipment, here's some objects, just do stuff, play on it, you know, make your own emergent whatever. That's just the kind of designer he is, that he's just like, you know, here's some fun stuff.
His philosophy makes sense if you look at Katamari, the first game, because the least fun levels are the ones that require the most skill and are the most game-like. Like the ones where it's like, find the biggest cow, and if you touch anything that's not, a huge cow, the level's over.
It's a cow!
Those levels are terrible, and I'm glad they didn't do that in the second game. They're just not fun at all.
Well, there are other gimmicky levels, and some of them work better than others. But
yeah.
You spend 30 minutes trying to build up as big as you can to get the biggest bull, and then you touch the tiny cow and it screws it all.
Or you touch you touch a carton of milk or something like that, and it counts. Yeah, it's like the game tricking you.
Right.
But I did want to point out that this will date this episode hugely, but I want to point out that we're living in the era of Marie Kondo and KonMari, the cleaning up your crap technique. And this game is very much about recognizing the clutter of the world, just how the world is full of objects and they're like in every corner. And you don't think about it until you are very small and rolling around and just seeing everything, all the junk and garbage everywhere in every home.
Yeah, they should make a KonMari Damashi game.
Oh my God, that's perfect.
Wow.
How did I not think of that pun?
I definitely started, looking at that. Like when I was really into the game, when I was first playing, I get the thing, like, you know, they talk about like, the Tetris effect. If you've been playing too much Tetris, you start thinking about how real world things would fit together. And I totally had that with Katamari when I was first playing it, where I would look at my desk and say, okay, if I were this size, first I would roll up all those little things over there, and then the paper clips, okay, and then the pencils, and then that stuff, and then really are a lot of things in my room.
Last night, my family had a dinner together, where all my cousin-in-laws and their kids and so forth came over, and my youngest niece, who's like 18 months old, found this little toy that had gone missing, I don't know, like 2 years ago. I was like, I had totally forgotten it existed. And all of a sudden she was walking around with it, because I guess she was the only one who was small enough and at the right level to find where it had fallen behind a cabinet or whatever. I was like, well, that's bad for you. You can't put that in your mouth. You choked to death on Golgo 13. And that's bad. But it does tie into the idea that in this game, you are a very small person looking at the world and from starting out, at least from a very kind of ground eye perspective, and it changes the nature of everything that's around you. So, why don't we actually talk about what Katamari Damacy is? We've talked game? About how it's wonderful for 20 minutes, but I guess we should actually how do you play this game? First of all, let's say that the title, Katamari Damacy, is of course Japanese, and it essentially means like cluster of souls. Damacy is like a kind of stylish, hip way of saying tamashi, which means soul. So the name, when it's written in Japanese, is like two very complicated kanji characters that look very similar. So there's a lot of like layers of meaning happening there that don't necessarily come through in English, but that's okay because it doesn't need to. No one's going to say like Katamari Damacy, you mean that other game? Like it kind of communicates for itself, I think, in a way that works. But the name does kind of speak to the design of the game. I've been talking a lot, so I'll let someone else describe the game.
Well, all right, we want to talk about how it works. So you are the prince, this little character pushing around the Katamari, which is this clump that stuff sticks to, and you're trying to roll up stuff and make your clump bigger. Anytime you roll up something that's sufficiently smaller than your current clump, it sticks and it makes the clump bigger. And you're trying to get to a certain, most levels, at least in the original game, you're trying to get to a certain size in a certain amount of time, although there's various other criteria sometimes. But to do this, this is an interesting thing about the game, is you've basically got tank control. So you're using your dual analog sticks forward and back on the left and the right, so you can swivel and forward and back. And honestly, I'm pretty sure this is the first game with tank controls that I actually enjoyed since like Tank, like the Atari game, or like the Vector game, you know? I can't think of Battle Zone and Tank. Like, I can't think of anything else in between that actually employed tank controls that I didn't hate.
It feels very natural.
It feels very natural when you're rolling this thing. Yeah, in a way that it doesn't if you were just trying to control a character or a, you know, some kind of fast vehicle or something.
Yeah, I haven't played a game that has controls like this in a long time, but when I went back to Katamari Reroll, I found it was like super natural. I just fell right back into it. And actually, I've been playing it way more effectively and getting much better results than I did back when I played it on PS2.
This is a funny point. Is I always assume these controls were very natural. And I was talking about how cool Reroll is on Twitter. And one or two people replied and said, I downloaded the demo. I didn't know how the hell to play this game. Hmm. It was really unintuitive. And I couldn't figure it out. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's not intuitive to other people.
Well, if you've never played anything with those kind of tank controls, you know, if you start out trying to control it with one of the sticks, you're not going to get the results you expect.
It's not as great with the Switch sticks because they're not right. But this brings another point, which is the prototype for Katamari Damacy was developed on the GameCube.
That sounds awful.
They actually would have used. Can you imagine playing that with one of the C-stick and the other thing at the same time?
That sounds really bad.
I can see people today being confused by the controls because I feel like in 2003, you were used to, like, with every new game, it's time to learn how this game controls uniquely. Mm-hmm. But now everything is much more standardized, so I feel like it's harder to adapt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've played Assassin's Creed and you've played Call of Duty, so you know how every game
plays. Yeah, you're used to having one stick direction and the other stick camera, which is not what it is at all.
And R2 always shoots.
Yeah, you're right. And yeah, they did that for racing games too. You always know what's accelerate and what's brake and stuff. But the funny thing is, for the Switch Pro controller is more like an Xbox controller, but the Wii U Pro controller would have been perfect because it has two analog sticks at the same level up high. That would have been the perfect
Can you not use the Wii U Pro controller with the Switch?
I don't know. I don't think so.
I've been using the Switch Pro controller. I think it works the best out of the two ways I've tried to control it.
I need an adapter, I think, to use it. I only ever
use my Switch as a handheld system, and I think I don't feel like the lateral displacement of the sticks has any impact whatsoever on how I play. It's totally comfortable and fine. But I mean, I'm not going to tell people they're wrong if it affects them because, okay, I get it. Like, everyone's brain is wired differently and responds to controls differently. But like for me, it just feels totally natural going back into it. And I was really gratified. I was kind of worried about that. Like, will I be able to play this game still? And yes, absolutely. I'm like racking up amazing scores on my first time through stages, and I'm like, wow, I can't believe I'm this good at this game. I didn't used to be this good. I guess I just needed like a 10-year hiatus.
Yeah, or 10 years of games in the interim to practice on, like other Katamari games.
I've suffered through a bunch of NES and Super NES games now, so if I can deal with Ghosts and Goblins, I can deal with this.
That's true.
Yeah, I played through these a lot back in the day, so I basically 100%ed Katamari and We Love Katamari and Katamari Forever, like collected every single object in all of them. So I got pretty good at them after playing
So we should talk about the story to the games because it is kind of like tied into the gameplay. Like there is a reason you're rolling this sticky ball around, and that is because your dad is a jerk.
Pretty much.
Yep. Yeah. And so there's like this undercurrent of parental alienation running through these games that would be really sad and maybe a little like depressing if the games weren't so lighthearted and fun. But the game begins with the king of all cosmos, who is this, how would you describe what he even looks like? He's a strange looking fellow.
He's fabulous.
He's like wearing like a singlet or something.
Disco fop.
Mm-hmm. But disco fop. All the royal family has this weird thing around their heads. I don't know what it is. It's like a tube that their head is like in the center of. It's really hard to describe. But anyway, he gets drunk, and in his glorious bender, he breaks all the stars in the sky. So then he's like, "Well, kid," his son, he's like, "You gotta clean up your old dad's mess. I'll be watching you and judging you from afar." So then your job is to just roll up crap on Earth and send it into space and turn that stuff into stars. Like, cosmologically, it doesn't make any sense, but it's a fun premise, and it gives you an excuse to roll around.
You feel the cosmos.
You do feel the cosmos.
And in the second game, you learn about his tortured past, and I guess how he became an alcoholic.
Oh, I don't remember that part. It's been a long time since I played. Yeah, that had the flashbacks.
You learn about how the cycle of abuse is passed down through generations.
That's crazy. Well, I the first time I played the first Katamari game, I don't know how well I picked up on that vibe of the dad and son dynamic, but when I played it again on the reroll, and now I'm a father, I really picked up on it. I was like, wow, there is some kind of hidden pathos here that he's, you know, not hidden, but it's a subtext of this parental discord between the father and child going on.
Yeah, he's not a good dad.
Yeah.
He's very like dismissive and abusive, not in a physically abusive kind of way, just
emotionally.
He's kind of crappy to his son.
He
acts like he's being very benevolent to you, but he's just an entitled jerk.
Pretty much, yeah. So your job is basically to clean up your dad's mess, and as you play through the game, you roll your ball around, and stuff sticks to it. And the more stuff that sticks to it, the larger it becomes. The larger it becomes, the bigger the objects you can pick up. So it's this very satisfying loop of gameplay where you're constantly growing the scale of the object you're pushing around, and you can pick up more and more stuff. And it sounds really simplistic and, you know, almost to the point of ridiculousness, but it's so addictive. Like just the process of becoming larger and crossing over these barriers. Like some levels have, you know, little signs that say like, you must be 5 meters to pass through here. Mm-hmm. So when you pass through there and you start picking up things that you couldn't before, it's very satisfying. When things are much larger than you, they'll walk around heedless of you. Like they
kick you around.
Yeah, they don't care that you're there. They just bump into you and you go flying and stuff falls off your Katamari. Yeah. But then later you get bigger and you can pick them up and add them to your ball.
I feel like it's
vengeance.
Yeah, it's like a narrative that, it's not, what's the word? It's like a parable for control and gaining control over your life. Like you're kicked around as a little kid. Everybody kicks you around, and then it's so satisfying to grow bigger and then be able to kick and just absorb all those people who are kicking you around. And then you get to destroy the whole world essentially by absorbing it. Eventually, you know, the houses, buildings and everything.
There's very few games that like play with the sense of scale to this extent. So, like, you know, in the very beginning, you're getting pushed around by mice. And then even in the first level, you can get big enough that you can roll them up and you're like, okay, that's how this works. You know, we get bigger in the room and stuff. But it just keeps going. And then,
you're literally rolling up the continents.
Yeah, there's the first time
there's
you roll
nowhere
up a person,
else to go.
And then there's the first time you roll up a house, and then you're like rolling around like, cities.
Crap.
And
Well, there's one I forgot to add about the father dynamic. There's also that story of the kids and the father going to space. So there's another father.
The Machino family.
Thing going on with that story, which I don't remember the exact story, but I think he's an astronaut.
And the girl is the one who feels the cosmos.
And then don't they say something like it's the flight's delayed because there's nowhere to go. There's no moon. Like something like
right,
that. Doesn't
right,
that happen?
Yeah. That was in the cutscenes in the first game. Like you have to rebuild space before they can have a space program again.
That's funny.
So the Hoshino family barely even factors into the game, but a lot of the story is told through their eyes. And it's just like, you know, a nuclear family, a father, mother, two kids, a son and a daughter, and they're kind of outsiders and picking up some of the details about what's happening through the news. And then occasionally being like, oh, hey, that seems weird. Oh, there's something happening. And then occasionally the girl will be like, oh, the constellation has come back. I feel the cosmos.
Yeah. And the first time I played that, that was the weirdest thing I'd ever seen in a video game. The most bizarre sort of like tangential, strange, abstract thing. But today, you know, where nothing is a surprise anymore because we have the internet and we've known and seen every sort of bizarre permutation of human behavior and culture, it seems so tame and nothing. Like, I can't imagine a person coming to it today who's a younger generation ever feeling the same thing I felt when I played it, because it was just such a new thing compared to the Western localized titles that we had. They censored all that bizarre Japanese kind of stuff from us. I mean, what was bizarre to us anyway? But this is the full force. You get it.
Anyway. Plus, I still feel like it's kind of poignant that you've just got this sort of little tangential side story about these characters who are essentially just pieces in the game. Mm-hmm. You know, you end up rolling them up, you end up rolling up their house, but they've got, you know, their own life going on that's just sort of there in the little background cutscenes.
Da-ba-da-ba. 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 I know you love me. I wanna word you up into my life. Let's roll up to be a single star in the sky. I hear you calling me. I wanna word you up.
Oh, no, it's okay. I was going to talk about just how technically well-made this game is. Like, creatively, it's brilliant, but the technical aspect of it is amazing. Everything is very low polygon and very, like, low texture quality, so they can fit a lot of things on the screen. But playing again, I noticed how effectively they cull out smaller items as you grow. They just remove them from the world, and you don't really notice.
Yeah, they use those, like, your milestones where the King of All Cosmos comes and talks to you. They use that as kind of like a loading screen. Like, you'll hit a certain goal, and there'll be that, and the like screen kind of gets blurry, and then the king pops up, and he talks to you. And I'm pretty sure that's masking, like, a deload for certain objects and putting other things into memory.
It definitely is. Well, and so I think it's switching stuff between being background and being interactable when you do that.
Yeah, so it's like it's very efficient and very thoughtful. Yeah, like you didn't see a lot of that sort of thing happening.
Yeah,
and it's especially smart because, you know, the disc speed on the PS2 was not the greatest.
Right.
In the world.
Yeah, like in later games on the HD systems, they didn't have to do that anymore because you could just dynamically load whatever you needed as you needed it. But yeah, back on PS2, you had to have some finesse to pull this kind of thing off.
And there's really no physics system in the game. Like, they're proprietary programmed in physics, I guess, but it's amazing to think that there's no physics happening in the way that we think of them today.
Yeah, it's not like Havoc or something. It's like you bump into something and pieces fly off and then they just kind of lay around. You can go pick them up. But it's not like realistically modeled gravity and, you know, objects aren't reflecting each other. Yeah, there's no ragdolls, thank God. Like, when you knock into a person, they go spinning, but they're like stiff. They're like bowling pins.
They're just sort of rotating.
Like a game piece, really.
Yeah, exactly. Like, the whole thing, the low poly look that you mentioned, Bob, it's a key to the design of the game. And even the cutscenes, which are hand-drawn with the Hoshino family, like, they look like everything in the game. They're still blocky. So it's just like a pervasive art style. But the king and the prince don't look like that. It's just everything on Earth.
Yeah. But it's an aesthetic choice, and at the same time enables the technical feats they were doing with the game, that it all ties together as this aesthetic, but it also lets it actually run on this system with the amount of objects they were trying to deal with.
Yeah, and there aren't a whole lot of goals in the game. It's like you play through levels, and each level you're trying to get to a certain size, and then you have some of the variant levels like find the biggest cow or whatever, or get the most money. Was that? I think that was in the second game.
Or find all the fish for Pisces.
Yeah, so like that's and all the crabs for cancer. Yeah. And that's pretty much it. But, you know, like you can always go back to a stage and try to find a bigger goal, or like, you know, achieve a bigger score. End score. Yeah. And then within each stage, there's stuff hidden. There's a present from your father, like he forgot to give it to you and just left it on the world. So he kind of cares, but not enough to really bother. And also there are cousins. The prince's cousins are hidden within the world. And if you can roll them up, then you can play as them instead of as the prince.
I think
was that only the second one?
It was the second game when you could actually play as them. I think they were still there in the first game.
Right, that's right. I was trying to play as them in the Switch remake. And
This is part of the part of the reason I wish they would put out the second one too, is because it just expanded on a lot of these little things and fleshed them out a little more.
I love playing as the cousins and dressing them up in different hats and stuff like that.
Yeah, there's all wearable stuff that you can collect. But then also, in addition to like the explicit presence, there's also, so it, So it's keeping track in one of the menus through all these games of all the different kinds of objects you've collected, right? So
and
so
how many you've collected, right?
What and how many? Yeah, and so every single thing you collect. And if you get way too into these games, you can start, you know, if you've exhausted the explicit collectibles, then you can start thinking about, okay, what objects are there in the world that we haven't got? And there'll be some that, you know, there's one of this object in one obscure place in one level that you have to go super fast to get to a big enough size to pick it up while it's still there.
Wow. Are you speed running this game?
I mean, you sort of end up having to do that in order to get some of the things.
Do you know, if you're really good in the early things, can you get really big and still roll up bigger things that they don't really intend you to roll up? Is it within the time limit? Is it possible?
Really break it. I mean, in the first game, if you get to if you try to remember what the requirement for it was, but I'm pretty sure, you know, if you do really well, you can unlock unlimited time modes on some of the levels that'll just let you relax and just roll stuff for as long as you want. And at that point, you can pretty much just, you know, roll up everything that's rollable in the level, and you will hit. Wow. Hit boundaries at some point.
Well, you mentioned the collection screen, and I implore everyone who has this game to go into that screen and read the description for every object, because they're all written from the perspective of an outside observer, and they're all very funny, and they will teach you things about different objects in Japan that you might not know about.
I mean, they're written by the king, aren't they?
I think so.
He like doesn't really care that much about Earth or know that much about Earth. It's not, you get the impression that he's not like God in the sense that he didn't create everything. He's just like some cosmic entity who has the ability to destroy stars, and he's like, okay, Prince, go just use the resources you find on this world to make new stars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he has this outsider perspective, and he's just describing, and sometimes he describes things completely wrong. He'll just assume that some function is of something is, it's not what it is at all.
Yeah.
So yeah, the descriptions are great. But this collection aspect also enabled this whole kind of playground throwback community aspect to this game that I don't know if a lot of people got into, but there's communities online that people would be telling, you know, where they found these rare objects. And so I was Katamari on the Web was a big one that I was on through like all the first several games. I think it just recently moved, but it resurrected itself somewhere and you can still find it. And so there'd be things like in one of the games, this is actually another very Japanese thing. There was one of these like Japanese PE class like hurdle things that's made out of a bunch of stacked steps so that you can make it to whatever size you want. And so in a bunch of the levels, there's one of these hurdles that's made out of like 10 steps. So you roll over it when you're big and you get, you know, like step 1 through step 10. But it turns out there's actually like step 11 and step 12 in the game, but they're not in the like play yard. And like, I think the 12th step in one of the games is only found like, you know, 10 meters underwater in the ocean off the coast of some island in one of the stages. And, you know, eventually someone finds it and posts it. And then everyone's like, oh, we can finally get that part of our collection. And
that's so really obscure.
Yeah. And so there was this, kind of community aspect to just trying to track down all these last few objects that was a lot of fun if you're really spending a lot of time with the game and looking for things to keep doing.
Oh, that's great. I wish I had had time to invest in it, but you know, in the press it's always like, even if you are obsessed over a game like I was with this, you still have to move on to the next stuff. But you know, there is something to be said about the aesthetics of the game and just the way it looks. It's very unique and remarkable. And if you guys ever look at my refrigerator downstairs when you're recording here,
I do,
you might have noticed I have little Katamari magnets on my refrigerator that my sister made for me with Shrinky Dinks. Like, she got so into this game that she was just like making crafty things about the Katamari character. So I have a bunch of Katamari cousins.
That's awesome.
Like Miso, and I don't even like the strawberry one. Just a bunch of that she just made for me. And there's also like a little Shrinky Dink Katamari. And I love that she's, you know, crafty like that, but also that this game was just so captivating that it caught her attention like that. And that I got to be a beneficiary of it.
Really resonated with people. Like, you get people making up their own new cousins and stuff. You have your own Prince Sona or whatever.
The cousin thing is interesting. I got a different perspective of that with my 6-year-old daughter. We had played the Xbox 360 Katamari, which I forgot the name of it.
First. I think it's Beautiful.
Beautiful Katamari, yeah, beautiful, was the, yeah, Xbox one. Yeah.
She had played that, and she could pick any cousin she wanted. And then so we went back to re-roll, and she really wanted to pick another cousin, like to be a girl cousin or something, but we couldn't do it. So
yeah, because it's the first game.
I think the second one is the one where you can play as the cousins, mm-hmm, on any level.
After you roll them up, right, at a level, then. Yeah.
So what we're saying is they need to release We Love Katamari on Switch.
Yes, they do.
I hope this sold well.
Absolutely.
I think it's done pretty well. I feel like it has.
I feel like Bandai Namco waited too long, and I always wondered why they didn't bring this out earlier in any form. I believe Katamari 1 was re-released on PS3 digitally, but that was probably it.
I think so.
They had the download version of it that's just an emulation.
Yeah. Oh. But I think it's weird to think of this as a product of Bandai Namco, but it was really a product of Namco before they were subsumed and consumed, mm-hmm, by the corporate beast.
The later games are very much the corporate beast style, yeah, creations. Uh-huh. Okay, so we've talked a lot about the first game, but before we, you know, touch on the sequels, we have to talk about the music, because it's such an integral part of the Katamari experience. I mean, even if you don't like video games, it's, I don't know how you could listen to the soundtrack and not just be like, this is wonderful music. It's so unique. It's like nothing else in any other video game. And, you know, Namco always had really great composers, especially around this era. But even this, you know, like even within Bandai or within Namco, like this soundtrack stands out. It's incredible.
I burned it to a CD.
Yeah.
And listened to it in my car. So everyone knew the world's coolest man was driving into town.
But the interesting thing is I've heard that they were actually kind of like taken aback by how popular the soundtrack was, because like when they're putting this together, they were going for kind of a nostalgic, eclectic feel. And so they just pulled in all these random artists that they found, you know, who had maybe like had a hit 10 or 20 years ago and could use some work or something.
Yo, look,
I don't know any of these artists. Like, yeah, they mean nothing to me. I just know that they put amazing music in.
This soundtrack was my first exposure to J-pop, any kind of anything like that, or Japanese popular music or Japanese classical popular music.
I'm pretty sure most of these people were someone who had, like, I mean, maybe not a number one hit, but at least had something that was popular, but it was mostly 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah,
so, and they just pulled these people into the studio and said, like, yeah, do something new and just let them go. And like, so like I had written down here that like Que Sera Sera is by jazz singer Charlie Cosset, who did a bunch of music for Lupin the Third back in the day, which I, you know, I hadn't known at the time, but now that I think about it, that totally makes sense. Like that very much tracks, mm-hmm, that it's that kind of music.
Yeah, love it.
And there's just all this period stuff. There's like a mambo, there's some like kind of jazz room music.
There's a rap kind of raps. That's in the second game.
But yeah, it's just this eclectic bunch of stuff, and it's just amazing.
It was Yu Miyake, that's the musical.
Yu Miyake was the supervisor. Did a bunch of the did some of the composition, but then also let some of these other artists do their own thing.
He not only did some of the composition, but he pulled this whole thing together. Mm-hmm. So he's
absolutely,
this dude is a genius in my book. I personally use the Katamari soundtrack as like my crunch music when I have a deadline. About to, you know, I have to turn in something in an hour and I got to write 1,000 words or something. So I put it on and it gets me going.
I had Katamari on the Rock as my ringtone for years and years and years.
And the other thing about the soundtrack, funny thing is, I feel like the game would not be the same without the soundtrack. It's, mm-hmm, really great gameplay, but it's a really great soundtrack. So on Twitter last year, I posted a poll like, what percentage of coolness is the soundtrack versus the gameplay in Katamari? And I think the result was 50%.
That sounds right.
I mean, it feels good. Yeah.
Like you can enjoy the game without the music, and you can enjoy the music without the game, but the two together, it's awesome. Like, you know, Star Wars and the Star Wars soundtrack. Mm-hmm. Like neither, mm-hmm, would be fully complete without the other. They work together so perfectly. I don't remember what the name of the very final stage track is, but it just feels so, like it takes all the kind of motifs from, mm-hmm, throughout the game and, mm-hmm, just makes them feel grand. And, you know, this is, you know, the one where you're rolling up contents and you see a little Ultraman ripoff over there fighting and you roll them up. It's, you know, like it just feels grand. I think Andrew Vestal, formerly of the Gaming Intelligence Agency, described the final stage of Katamari Damacy as, riding down a hill on a bicycle and letting go of the handles. Like, it just has that sensation of speed, and it just like keeps going faster and faster and getting bigger and bigger. And
it's a rush. It's definitely an exhilarating rush to get bigger and have the time to actually get big enough to roll up the buildings and all that.
Yeah, they did that in both the first two games. Like, the first one, I think it was a variation of Katamari on the Rock in the first one. And the second one, the final stage, was Song for the King of Kings, where the King of Cosmos actually starts doing vocals halfway through.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is fantastic. Like, Katamari Damashi, da-da-da-da.
Yeah, but the soundtrack really runs the gamut. There's, you know, like the... We mentioned, what was it called? Kesara Sara, which is kind of like a Burt Bacharach sort of loungy sort of thing.
Jazz kind of stuff.
But then you have, I think, oh yeah, You Are Smart.
You Are Smart.
Which is like almost kind of abstract, and there's nothing like really to it except just like this voice saying, "You are smart."
Yeah.
That's all there is to it.
Stages where you're supposed to hit an exact size with the Katamari, so you have to like concentrate and figure out what you're doing.
But then you have the Lonely Rolling Star, which is like this wistful, beautiful song that doesn't seem like it should belong in a video game, and yet it's so perfect here.
That's the one. Is that the one where all the kids?
Cherry Tree Times is the one with the kids' chorus.
Oh, the Cherry Tree Times. Yeah, that one makes me miss my children.
Yes.
So when I was working, like if I got to that point, I'd start thinking, oh man, I got to finish this so I can go see my kids. So it kind of worked out. But the thing about the music is they had to design this music to be sufferable to repeated playings as you're playing the level. So they loop
it. Yeah, you get really long time. Well, and it does, if you listen to the soundtrack, it's got everything. It basically, it does the regular version and then it segues straight into a karaoke version where it plays all the backing tracks without the chorus, without the vocals, and then segues back. And so they get a lot of mileage out of each of these songs because, depending on the stage, you can be playing the same stage for like 10, 15 minutes, which is a long track.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I mean, Kesara Sara like goes on for a long time before it loops.
Yeah,
and it's a soundtrack that holds up really well as an independent release, like as a separate release. Like I said before, like Mondo Records released the soundtrack on vinyl last year, and it's just like it is kind of the quintessential sort of music that you want on vinyl. It's quirky and it's a little bit nostalgic. And it's a little bit inventive, and it just really takes advantage of the format and is like kind of the quintessential, like, oh, I'm showing off my record player kind of music. And the fact that it comes from a video game, that's kind of a bonus.
Yeah, and it really works its way into your head. Like, even if you're playing this long level, and then it'll go from the vocal version into the karaoke version, and I'll like just totally involuntarily start singing the vocals to fill it in, like just because you've just been listening to that up to that point. And yeah, it just makes it super memorable.
Yeah, if you ever have the chance to pick up that vinyl soundtrack, even if you don't own a record player, like I recommend it just because the packaging is so perfect.
That's really
like
they
went an extra step. Like each disc is a different color. It's, you know, like these very spring-like colors, bright green, lavender.
That.
And then the sleeves are this sort of acetate that has like white artwork printed on it over top of the records itself. It's just like they put a lot of heart into the packaging on this, and it just is a perfect little package of amazing music that goes with a fantastic video game. And I'm really glad that Katamari had this very unexpected but very welcome resurgence in 2018. And I really hope that Namco is able to kind of pick it up and carry it and do something with it. I would love to see some more re-releases on current consoles, but I'd love to see them, you know, really take the idea and do something new and yet spiritually faithful with it for the future.
Like Katamari Kart Racing?
Maybe not Katamari, no.
Katamari.
But I feel like there's potential in this series to do something more. And I don't know. Maybe they need to get Keita Takahashi back to give them some advice.
Yeah,
I don't know, but I want to think there's like something more for Katamari.
Yeah, I think so. I hope so. The last thing I have to say about the soundtrack is I consider it the greatest video game soundtrack of all time, maybe second to Super Mario Brothers.
Really, you were going to say Symphony of the Night?
Yeah, well, that's great too, but I feel like in terms of groundbreaking importance, two things stick out in my mind. Maybe Zelda, like Ocarina of Time or something. But, you know, there's so many games with so much great music, and it's so wonderful, and it always sticks out to me. But the two that really blew me away are Super Mario Brothers and Katamari Damacy. Because, I mean, it's just so damn good. It's just great. So, and I'm a musician, so I'm coming at this from a like a songwriter perspective. It's really delightful that they could write and conceive and produce something like that. That's the music.
All right, so we have a few minutes before we need to wrap this up. So why don't we talk a little bit just about some of the sequels? Bob said he only recognizes one. I don't think everyone else has quite so strict a guideline. But yeah, what is it about We Love Katamari, Bob, the 2005 sequel, that you think makes it so much more remarkable than the other sequels?
The controls are more refined. As we said before, you have the cousins that you can play as, and you can equip, I believe, two accessories on any character instead of just one present you find in the level, like in one. And I think the non-just roll up everything levels are way more fun and inventive and not as punishing as the, try to roll up the biggest single one item you can, like the cow level, or I believe the, there's another level of that kind in this game. I forget what the other thing roll up is.
There's a cow bear.
Those levels are I just roll up the first thing I see and end it because I can't stand those levels. But like the non-roll up everything levels are much more creative. There's one where you're rolling a sumo around and you're collecting calories, one where you're trying to make the biggest fire by rolling up things that will burn. It's longer.
Snowman head.
Yeah, and the music is not as good, but it's still very good. I just feel like it is the perfect sequel and the logical conclusion of this genre, this experience, whatever you want to call it. I feel like it should have ended there, and that's where it ends for me. And I really hope that they bring that out in HD because it is the superior game by a little bit.
I think I love the second one too because it did continue the good music from the first one. It's not quite as good as the first one, but it's almost as good. And it's so after that they started recycling the music for all the different games, the ones that I have anyway. Yeah, I've got like Beautiful and Forever or something.
Yeah.
So they remix them and recycle some of those songs. So
it's not as groundbreaking, but it's a fun set of tunes also.
But the We Love Katamari, I think the premise is something like Katamari Damacy was so popular that everyone wrote in, and they're always talking about the fans of Katamari want this or want that.
So you're doing that's the frame story. Instead of doing the bidding of your king, this time you're fulfilling requests from the fans.
Yeah.
So the prince, like
a self-referential kind of.
Yeah, you know, I think it's ultimately about Keita being unhappy with the success of being a game creator and the pressure of that too.
Yeah, there's one of the characters on the map screen that basically is Takahashi, and he's a pretty cynical little character. And this was the last game with his involvement because he's not the kind of guy to just want to iterate forever. Mm-hmm. He wanted to go do new stuff.
I am a fan of the cover of this game from Japan. I'm thinking it's this
great
game where it's like a photograph of just all the staff and a bunch of other people and a giraffe on top of the old Namco building. It was the building they had before they moved to the Bandai Namco headquarters. And so there's like this kind of time capsule element to it. It's very, I don't know, it's very sweet in that sort of way.
Yeah, and it's very like you get this vibe from Takahashi and from the whole game that like so the first game did so well and it like in a lot of ways unexpectedly well, I think, even for all the people who made it. And so he's like, okay, thank you. I'm glad everyone loved this. Here's some more of it. Have fun with this, but then like please go outside and play.
And it's called
with your life.
It's called We Love Katamari here in English, but the Japanese title is Mina no Katamari.
Yeah, everyone's
which
Katamari.
Is like everyone's Katamari. Mm-hmm. So it's meant to be like I really feel, I don't know, like I feel there's a difference between everyone and we. Like we is more like inclusive, whereas kind of first person inclusive, whereas everyone is just like, it's not just us, it's everyone beyond that. Wow, I really explained that well. Huh?
No, that makes sense. Like it's, you know, he was, I think the reason they talked him into doing a second one is he was doing it for the fans and he was willing to go out and do that one more time.
He's a lot like Fumito Ueda in that he was just came out of nowhere and was allowed to direct a game because the premise was so strong and that he immediately became successful. Like this is the first game he worked on from all I can tell.
I think he may have done some like tiny little demos and stuff before this, but this is his first published
like professionally published thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like a smash hit right out of the gate.
So I will say that I have a soft spot, a bit of fondness for Me and My Katamari, which was the PSP game, mm-hmm. which was, I guess, 2006.
Yes.
And it's not nearly as good as the other two, but the fact that I could play it on a car trip, like I took that on a Christmas vacation with me to visit my family. I think it was might have been before the US version came out, but I was just like, I can play Katamari on the go, and that's awesome. So
I can definitely see the appeal of that.
Yeah,
I didn't have a PSP, so I was always really curious. Like, you know, you had to use like the D-pad and face buttons
sucked.
For the tank.
I think you were using the triggers.
Oh, really?
To rotate, if I'm not mistaken.
Ooh, okay.
So yeah, it was very clumsy in that sense. Hmm. Like, yeah, the control scheme was not ideal, but you kind of had to make those compromises to play on a portable system.
It's not like there was a mobile system with D-sticks back then.
Yeah, I've played that one. I have it, but I think the controls sort of turned me off of it or something like that.
I can understand that.
Yeah.
I mean, even at the time, I was like, this isn't ideal.
But you're in a car playing Katamari.
Yeah. So, where cool. The series lost me was with Beautiful Katamari, which was the first HD game for mm-hmm. PS3 and 360. And
Beautiful was just 360.
Oh, was it just 360?
Yeah, just 360.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Beautiful was only, which
it was
is why
a,
I haven't
it was
played
a weird choice.
We were all like, why is this only 360 exclusive? But it was.
There's a reason.
Microsoft must have paid a lot of money for that.
There was some kind of reason where they were having technical problems with the PS3 version, so they just decided to drop it and go Xbox 360. Yeah.
Well, but then they kept on with it eventually. So.
Yeah, well, they went and did the other one.
Yeah.
Beautiful Katamari. I don't know. I just got it last year because I finally got an Xbox 360 last year. And I thought it was cool because it was the first HD one. I mean, I had played the PS3 one before, but it's neat. But it's like it feels like they just chopped up pieces of mm-hmm. other games and threw it together. And yep. that's what you get. So
yeah, like there was nothing about it that made me say, oh, this is fresh and exciting.
Yeah,
it's just like, oh, yeah, it's what I've done before, but the graphics are crispier.
Not a cohesive story kind of thing.
And that's even more so what Katamari Forever was, which was the first PS3 one, which is actually like 2 years later in 2009. Mm. But it brought in some of the 360 stages and then also just had straight up basically HD remakes of some of the stages from the first two games. Which, you know, I mean, at that point, it had been, 4 years since We Love Katamari. So I was fairly happy just to have it on a current system, you know, with and, you know, they used the HD to be able to put in more items at once and all that stuff. They had a new frame story that was suitably goofy with a Robo King. I don't know. I enjoyed Katamari Forever, and I 100%ed that one, too. But it's also, it's very much a remix game. It's got stages from basically all the previous games. It's got music from the previous game remixed. Although some of them were fun where they would just, like, seemed like they threw darts at a board and picked two songs from the previous games and, like, mashed them together into one song. And sometimes it didn't work so well, but sometimes it actually did and was kind of fun, so... Hmm. I don't know. It's not, it's not a bastion of originality or anything, but, you know, as a current gen Katamari experience, I enjoyed it.
I will say that it's not great, but I have spent a lot of time with I Love Katamari because it was one of the first games from a major publisher to hit a smartphone. Like, it was a very early iOS release, and it was just way too much game for the original iPhone to hold to mm-hmm. handle.
Yeah, I think I downloaded a demo of it and just kind of
it chugged. It was actually unplayable on the original phone. But every time I got a new iPhone, I would go back to I Love Katamari and be like, so how much better does this run? And eventually it was like the third iPhone, I think, finally got to a point where I was like, oh, yes, this is tolerable. And then I played some of it. It was like, okay.
So did you really play it with the tilt controls?
I can't remember. It's been, a decade.
Yeah.
I honestly can't remember, but I just use that as like my kind of go-to, how's my hardware doing?
Yeah. Several of the phone games actually just implemented like tilt controls. You literally like, rolling your marble around and it just...
Sounds bad.
I'm not a fan of that control mechanic. Kirby Tilt and Tumble also just doesn't do much for me. Like I want to be able to see my screen straight on, not tilted away from me.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, and there's... I think the latest one that came out mobile is Katamari Amore, and you can use tilt controls or you can use virtual thumbsticks. none of these solutions are actually good solutions.
There are one or two mobile games. One is for like a cell phone, and one is maybe iPad that aren't just the same gameplay. They're sort of like
there was a side scroller.
Yeah, there was like an infinite runner one or something. Or there was a cookie clicker one. Actually.
There's an infinite runner kind of one, and then there's a side scroller for something, and I don't remember. Yeah. I never paid much attention to them.
And I mean, these are totally just Bandai slapping the license on something to put something out. So they're pretty
They're just kicking a corpse around for at that point.
Pretty much.
And I actually forgot until I put the notes together for this episode that there was a release on Vita.
Vita, yeah.
Very early that I actually own.
Touch My Katamari.
According to Wikipedia, in a hands-on preview, 1UP.com's Jeremy Parrish had similar comments saying that the series now continues to miss the point. So I guess I didn't have good things to say about
that
it.
That sounds like you.
Yeah. That does sound like
I bet they made you use the back touch panel, too.
Gimmick for that game is you can use the back touch panel and you can either stretch out the Katamari wide to roll up more stuff, or you can squish it vertically to fit through little
That is the stupidest thing.
It was very much
anything involving back touch was just the I don't know how that escaped their labs. It's the worst.
Vita's life, Bob.
That's why I feel like Nintendo wasted a generation of games on DS when the first games all had to use a stylus to run around and all this crap. I hated that. So it's the same.
Yeah,
kind of
same with Wii. Same with Wii U. Like you got to get the gimmicks out of your systems.
So here's the question: is could you actually do something good with disconnected Switch controllers? That's different from what it's done before.
I mean, they use the Joy-Cons.
It seems like it'd be pretty easy to do tank controls that way.
Yeah, they do. They do. You can re-roll. You can use the Joy-Cons separately.
Okay.
I haven't tried it, but they say you can.
Do you like using the D-sticks or do?
I literally only ever use my Switch as a handheld system,
so I can't
speak to that. Sorry.
I'm gonna have to go home and try that again because I haven't done it with the tilt.
Reroll is as short as the first game. Exactly as short, and it's very, you can get through it pretty quickly. So I just played through it as fast as I could because it was awesome and it's over.
I'm just wondering if they could actually get stuff together to do a new one. What would we want from the new one?
Yeah, that's a great closing question.
I have an idea. They should make an arcade game with a giant ball you can actually push around. It's rotating on a platform.
Kind of like the table flipping game?
Katamari flipping game.
A huge roller ball.
Like a track ball.
A giant track ball.
Yeah, and something that could actually crush small children. You know, it's really big.
Like beach ball size, but you can roll it side to side? Yeah.
I'd be okay if it were just like a golden tea-sized track ball.
Or a golden tea. Like a wheel that you can also kind of tilt while you're pushing it, so it can be stationary and you can move it, you know, so that'll push the ball instead of having to have a 360 ball.
Giant 360 track ball because it is a ball.
I don't know how you'd mount it in place, and to keep it there, unless it's just extremely heavy, like a giant granite sphere suspended on water.
Well, I mean, you could have it like a real track ball where it's half submerged.
That's reasonable.
That's fun.
So that works for arcades, but for like a home system, you can't really do that.
Yeah.
What else? Well, there's no feature in the home. It has to be the arcade.
Yikes.
Yeah, I can't really think of what I want from Katamari or what I would do with the series. I just know that I want it to continue and to do new things. I realize that's not very helpful. That's like
my opinion is less helpful.
I don't have anything to offer, but keep doing awesome stuff.
My opinion is less helpful. I want there to be no future for the series. I want the first two games to be available forever on every platform, and that's it. Period.
Yeah.
Shut it down, Obama.
That's fair.
He doesn't have any say anymore.
Do something different.
He can shut down one game. He's powerful enough. He's got a Netflix series.
All right. So I think we're out of time, so we will wrap at this moment. So guys, why don't we... say our Katamari farewells by signing off and saying where you can find us on the internet. Of course, Retronauts, a podcast, is on iTunes, and I don't know what network we'll be on by the time you hear this, but you can go to iTunes and you can go to retronauts.com and find the podcast there. You can also support us on Patreon by subscribing. You get episodes early and higher bitrate quality with no ads. That's patreon.com/retronauts. And your patronage makes this podcast possible. Bob, why don't you do your thing?
Sure. Hey, it's Bob Mackie. I'm on Twitter as Bob Servo, and I host two other podcasts, Talking Simpsons, which is a chronological exploration of The Simpsons, and What a Cartoon, where we look at a different cartoon from a different series every week. And Jeremy has been on What a Cartoon for our episodes about the Max and G.I. Joe, so those were pretty great. And he'll be back in the future, I assume, I hope. Probably. That's good. Yeah. Okay. Well, it's an agreement now. But if you check out our, we have our own Patreon. It's at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. If you go there and subscribe, you'll get hundreds of bonus podcasts. And by the time this episode comes out, we should be doing our miniseries Talking of the Hill, which is our podcast series about the first season of King of the Hill, and that'll be available for $5 subscribers. So we have other limited series like Talking Futurama and Talking Critic, and Jeremy's been on Talking Futurama as well, and those are only available out the Patreon at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. And that's it for me.
And I'm Benj Edwards. Right now I am building joysticks at bxfoundry.com, and believe it or not, this is something I'm not making up. I have been working on a dual stick Katamari joystick.
No kidding.
Yes, to play right. Katamari, because someone suggested it. So I'm trying to target the system. I want one for Switch. I'm playing with analog and digital representations of analog. But since I've done the dual stick Virtual Boy thing, it seemed like an extension.
I love how specific these are getting.
Yeah, well, it's the fun. It's so much fun to do it. Like the ridiculousness of just a controller for one game, but it's fun.
You gotta let me borrow it before you ship it out.
Yeah, sure. I could build you one,
All right, and Ben.
I'm Ben Elgin. I am on Twitter as Kirin, K-I-R-I-N-N. I sometimes have a retro blog at Kirin's Retro Closet at Tumblr, but I'm probably going to move that and relaunch it somewhere else. I'll let you all know if you keep following the podcast. And that's about it, because I don't have a Patreon.
All right. And finally, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, as GameSpite on Twitter. And you should also check out my YouTube channel, the Retronauts Video Works Project, where I've been chronicling the complete history of a lot of video game systems, including Virtual Boy. And let me tell you, there's actually some pretty rad stuff on Virtual Boy that was obscured by the fact that the system was garbage. So check that out. And we'll be back with another podcast in a week and every other Friday with a bonus episode. Look forward to it. Goodbye.